Welcome to another edition of Radioactive Magazine on KKFI with this week's host, Dave Mitchell. On February 20, we interviewed John Shively discussing the increasing polarization in our politics. John is an instructor of political science and history at Longview Community College and Lee's Summit, and in our last interview, we both felt a strong need to continue the conversation. So, John, welcome back to Radioactive Magazine.
Good to be back. Thank you for having me.
In our prior conversation, I pointed to observations by Harriet Lerner, PhD psychologist, on the effect of chronic anxiety on human systems. Common traits identified were rigidified thinking, a loss of objectivity, a steep decline in civility, cooperation, and empathy, a lack of orientation to the facts, an inability to tolerate complexity, and a pushing of people to extremes. All these traits are characteristic of polarizing dynamics. In our prior interview, we noted President Trump has not caused our polarization, although he is definitely making it worse. We talked about the multiplying of media outlets, development of information silos, the moving to ideological extremes with a demand for ideological purity, a demonizing of the other side, and a disagreement over basic facts or even what the problem is. Let's look at some of our social developments over the last 40 years, which have been contributing factors in our polarization. In our private discussion on polarization, you pointed to declining educational and health systems, an increased sense of scarcity and fear, the fact the U.S. is not as dominant as it once was as contributing factors to our polarization. Can you expand on these themes?
One thing I would like to add to that, too, is a distrust in institutions. I think if you go back to Vietnam and Watergate, that era, 60s and 70s, prior to those rather political debacles, there was a pretty good consensus that most people trusted government. The government was doing the right thing. It wasn't as corrupt. Now we're even demonizing the institutions that we have trusted throughout most of American history, particularly in modern times. You have a president and others who are attacking the FBI, they're attacking the CIA, they're attacking the foundations of our democratic system, voting, who can vote, who can't vote. All of these things are tie into what we've already talked about, fear. And now, who do you look to? How do you begin to rebuild a consensus that has been pretty well destroyed over the last 40 years? There have been attempts, but every time an attempt is made, then something else happens. Government has another screw up. You have Bill Clinton's scandal when he was president, the Iran-Contra affair, and Reagan's presidency after he'd done a really nice job of trying to restore the prestige of the office. And now we're at a point where we don't trust government. We don't trust each other. To use your term, are almost tribal. Who do you trust? You trust your family. You sort of look inward. You put blinders on. When you're fearful, your whole field of vision narrows, and you cannot look beyond that, which also means that you're not thinking outside of the box to solve problems. And I do think that moving forward, tying in with there are problems that exist, and the educational system is obviously creaking right now, and people aren't thinking that education is such a good deal, such an important part of life, that I don't know at this point where you move forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are things. I think that there is a general sense, I think, on the part of most people that, that our educational system really is failing our young, and our health system is also not supporting a great many of us, and even in support of many of us, it can be very expensive, and I think and there's also the sense there's also the reality of wage stagnation over the last 30 or 40 years, along with decline of the middle class, and that hits people where it hurts the most, in their gut, and then you made the comment that the U.S. is not as dominant as it once was, and can you expand on that theme more?
Sure. I think it's twofold. One, clearly there have been other nation states that have risen to the U.S. challenge. China is an economic powerhouse. You're looking at India as perhaps being one of the next economic powerhouses. We have competition that we hadn't really had economically until the 1970s with Japan, but Japan has gone through some unstable economic times, so they don't really threaten us as much. So economically, I think there are challenges, but also in terms of leadership. And this is one of the issues that I think is bothersome to sort of some of the old-time observers of our politics over the last sort of half century, is that the United States is not exerting the leadership around the world that we used to. The two wars with Afghanistan and Iraq are examples. Trying to put together coalitions for those two was a tough haul for President Bush. The idea of trade agreements have been in place for a long time, and now our current president wants to disrupt those because, well, we're not benefiting from those the way we used to. But I think part of the problem is you might argue that, well, that's an economic thing we have to fix. But a trade agreement is more than just your immediate benefits. It's also your relations with other countries and solving problems around the world. And so we are in a position that we can't exercise the leadership we used to, and now we won't exercise the leadership that we still have. There's this inward looking, and it goes internationally. It reflects our same view of what's happening in our domestic politics. It's like we're looking inward, and so we're sort of Fortress America. We're building the walls around us, and we're not really wanting to have a negotiation with somebody or talk to them. Mm-hmm. And our current president claims, and to a somewhat true vision, is he's a deal maker. And he is a deal maker, and he's made lots of deals. But I think the nature of the office and the nature of politics isn't the business world. And he doesn't understand that the leverage he thinks he has doesn't exist. You know, so we pull out of NATO. Europe's going to go do what they're going to do anyway. So we pull out of...
Well, we haven't pulled out of NATO.
No, but that's Trump's question, whether we should ever be... We should still be in NATO.
He did threaten it at one point.
Right.
And he did pull out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Correct. And they've gone ahead and negotiated one without us.
And my understanding is that is actually been pretty damaging to U.S. economic interests. But I'm not an economist or well-versed on that subject. But
I'm not either. But trade agreements are more than just the trading relationship, because it leads to other types of cooperation.
Right.
And I think if the United States is not cooperating with others, why would they cooperate with us?
On anything else.
Anything. Let's say, you know, Donald Trump has talked about going over to North Korea and having a discussion with Kim Jong-un. Why would Kim Jong-un be willing to enter any type of agreement with us when we have been doing nothing but breaking the agreements that we've made? Mm-hmm. Either recently, such as the Iran nuclear deal, Trump is talking about wanting to break that, or the NAFTA agreement, which was done in the 1970s,
He wants to renegotiate that.
Right. And so I think what we're showing to the world is chaos, because I think we feel chaotic somewhat in this country. Mm-hmm. And I think the rest of the world sees that, and it's an opportunity for others to move into sort of that leadership vacuum, because someone is going to. And I think, honestly, Vladimir Putin wants to do that.
Okay. I know one of in our private conversation, we kind of talked we briefly talked about Newt Gingrich and his political warfare tactics back in the 1990s. Can you kind of my understanding is that a lot of he significantly contributed to polarization, polarization process that we're engaging in from that time on. Although I'm sure he didn't start it. But could you talk about him a little bit?
Newt Gingrich is someone he's even interviewed today as sort of the elder statesman of the Republican Party, and someone who has, you know, a rich perspective on the events of the time, and that his opinions carry some weight. Back in the 1990s, he was the minority leader of the House of Representatives, and he was successfully able to maneuver the ouster of Jim Wright, who was a Democratic Speaker of the House, And then in 1994, he engineered the Republican takeover of the House, the first time the House of Representatives switched from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party control since the 1950s. And he was able to exploit divisions within the Democratic Party, and the type of politics he used, for lack of a better term right now, would be really hardball. And he made it personal. And he would find the things, instead of attacking your colleagues based upon their policy views, he would do things that dealt with their personal lives or their personalities or who they were. And maybe they'd done nothing wrong, but it's no different than like Donald Trump nicknaming somebody how he does nowadays, like Pocahontas for Elizabeth Warren. And Newt Gingrich is a very intelligent person, and he employed Machiavellian tactics. He's read Machiavelli's The Prince and Sun Tzu, The Art of War. And so he understands how to manipulate the system in order to produce the result he wants, and it's a take-no-prisoners attitude. He really changed the tenor of politics within our institution, the U.S. House of Representatives.
And was so do you regard that development as was that a key moment in our polarizing politics?
Yes, absolutely, because I think the election of Bill Clinton in 1992 in many ways was viewed by the Republicans as an illegitimate presidency. And the Republicans spent Bill Clinton's entire presidency trying to undermine Bill Clinton's presidency, whether dredging up things that he was allegedly into some corruption before he became president. That's the first time a sitting president had ever been attacked or had faced investigations on pre-presidential activities. And then, unfortunately, Bill Clinton handed him a perfect issue that sort of legitimized that whole process. Mm-hmm. And what you're seeing now with Donald Trump, and I'm not going to place a value judgment on this, but it happened with Clinton and with Trump. Now they're looking at all these things that everyone say, oh, that was 10 years ago, that was 15 years ago. Hey, that's what started. Mm-hmm. But the Republicans really went on a full offensive against Bill Clinton. And then
it becomes
tit for tat. Right. It's right. Okay. You, every time each party ups the bar a little bit. Now, and I would argue that I think there's enough evidence to show that the Republicans are probably A, better at this kind of warfare than Democrats are, but B, they've been doing it more consistently over the last 20 years than the Democrats have.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that kind of leads into our next question. And there is. I have no idea how, but in the mail recently, I received a material from the Faith and Freedom Coalition, a conservative Christian political organization. Their founder and chairman is Dr. Ralph Reed, who's the former executive director of the Christian Coalition from 1989 to 1997, for those of you who remember. Their letter and voter registration confirmation survey contains narratives which demonize the other side, in this case, the left. Demonizing of those of a different viewpoint is part of the polarizing process. Their letter begins with, "Dear Christian American Patriot," and it asserts that the anti-Christian left are doing everything in their power to destroy President Trump and block his legislative agenda to make America great again. The letter talks about the anti-Christian, anti-freedom, anti-America left, about how they want to erase America's borders, eliminate Christianity as a moral force in American life, and have the UN govern the U.S. instead of our Constitution. The letter talks about a corrupt political cartel comprised of Republicans, Democrats, the lobbying industry, and the media are out to destroy President Trump, and if this happens, the America you love as a Christian is over. Obviously, there is a request for donations to achieve their goal of over $11 million for their 2018 battle plan, quote unquote. The Faith and Freedom Coalition claims significant political clout, stating they made 155 million contacts with conservative Christian voters in 2016, that 40% of those voters identify as conservative Christians, that 81% of these cast their vote for Donald Trump in 2016. Obviously, to claim the left wants to essentially destroy America, especially Christian America, as well as give up our national sovereignty to the UN requires powerful emotion coupled with fantastical ideation. It seems this letter reflects cultural dynamics that precede Trump by 30 or 40 years at least and displays a great deal of fear. President Trump has become a symbol of protection with powerful emotions attached to him, and this may explain much about the seemingly unwavering support among his base. In our last interview, you talked about the silent majority, with those on the extremes making the most noise, as well as moving away from the views and feelings of those in the middle. I wonder how much these ideations in the Faith and Freedom Coalition material, as fantastical as they are, penetrate to the silent majority of conservative Christians' feelings and attitudes. What is your assessment of this material in the context of our political polarization?
Well, being the historian, I want to make a comment. Religion has always played an outsized role in American politics. I think part of it is because we are more diverse religiously than most other countries around the world. I do think that there were attempts made at the founding and with the framers to try to divide church and state as best they can, but they haven't since, I would argue, the 1980s, religion has become a much greater force in our politics than at any time prior to that. Part of the idea here that you're talking about and what they're trying to do is say, look, they're equating religious values with political values. They're trying to say that, in many ways, God ordained the United States to be this special country, and now you have this group of people who disagree with God's choice, and now you are, you know, a heathen or whatever term you want to use, but you deserve to be demonized and dealt with appropriately. The issue, though, is I can't think of a single Democrat who believes in any of the things that was in the letter that you received. Certainly not said. I mean, no one that I know in politics has said we should subordinate ourselves to the United Nations.
Well, it's a fantastical claim, and I think the issue, though, is it can't be that most conservative Christians would believe this.
I would argue, you mentioned the silent majority. I think a lot of that group, they go to church every day, but they don't it's more of a personal experience as opposed to, okay, this is a movement now, and we have certain goals politically that we're trying to achieve, and that we decided that this person, Donald Trump, will achieve our political goals. Because arguably, what I don't understand, and I find the contradiction, is with all the allegations about Trump's personal life and having affairs or a series of extramarital relationships, or the fact that he's been divorced 3 times and he was having an affair with his current wife while he was still married to his previous wife. To me, that seems rather unchristian, and these people are obviously supporting him despite those views. So the issue isn't about religious values. I think religion is the sort of cloth that this organization, for example, wants to wrap itself in, because it appeals to people and it appeals to a certain type of people. And you have, obviously, those who are religious are much more, less compromising of their views. Religion is not something that is easily compromisable, which is why the framers thought it shouldn't be part of our politics. But you can't really divorce someone's own personal views, religious views, from the decisions that they make, either when they go to the voting booth or when they contribute to a campaign or to a candidate or to an organization such as the Freedom Coalition.
You know, the thing of it, though, is that the letter talks about how if Donald Trump cannot be supported, and the intent of the letter is to do a campaign to preserve the Republican majorities in the House and the Senate, and therefore to support President Trump. And, you know, and if the Democrats take over the House, President Trump, they're going to try to impeach President Trump. And that that if this happens, the Christian America that you identify and love is going to end, and just such a, you know, these just the profound catastrophic emotion, you know, behind that is kind of blows me away. Really, it's really quite, and you know, it amazes me.
Back in 1947, when Harry Truman is president and they're working on rebuilding Europe and building NATO and the beginning of the Cold War and creating what we now would call the national security state, Republican Senator Arthur Vandenberg told Truman that if you want to accomplish this, you're going to have to scare the hell out of the American people. Even back then, people understood that fear is a good motivator. And so how do you get people to donate to your cause? You have to instill the fear that if they don't donate, they are personally contributing to the demise of this country. And I do think that when you're looking at the nature of the letter and the language that is used, it is very definitely meant to instill fear into them that all these bad things are going to happen. And it's almost as if, and those who are significantly religious, I don't know what word you want to use to describe that, but who look at like Revelations and the idea of the apocalypse and so forth, these are folks who think it's probably going to be in the next, you know, 10 or 20 years. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, a lot of people supported Donald Trump because they thought he might actually be able to bring that about, because the apocalypse leads to a better future.
Mm-hmm. Well, but part and parcel of that entire kind of thought process, though, is demonizing the other side, which allows all sorts of behavior that
Correct.
You would not ordinarily engage in.
It's easy to treat when you demonize the other side, and you're basically saying they're not appropriate human beings. It's easy to treat them badly.
Yeah, they're not fellow American citizens who have
Right.
a different viewpoint than you. They are people who are basically evil and are trying to destroy the America that you know, and that doesn't hold any water, really.
Correct. And I think, I mean, short of calling them, you know, disciples of Satan, would have been about the only thing they could have said more explicitly. But I think that's what they're trying to say, is these people that don't agree with us and that they don't view America this particular way, they are the enemy. Mm-hmm. They are the force of evil, as you said. And I think that's a really good way of characterizing it.
Okay. And, you know, not to be I personally don't exclude the left from engaging in somewhat similar processes in their attitudes towards people who hold conservative views. And you know, there is that element in the left that engages in a similar emotional dynamic. That's my own personal view.
No, I think that's accurate. And as you see the ascendance of the right, the left is emerging to be that sort of counterweight on the other side. And to be successful and to be a counterweight, they are, you know, the left, who should be supporters of free speech, are the ones who want to have free speech zone or safe zones on college campuses. They want to prevent certain people from speaking on college campuses mm-hmm. because of their views. And I think that's to understand that the left will have to mirror the right in order to survive. Now you're talking about the bigger problem that we started last week. How do you then get them back together? There is talk I read this morning about, is there a liberal Tea Party now, as opposed to the conservative Tea Party? Is there a liberal group emerging that's going to be just like the Tea Party? Or like the Freedom Caucus in the House, is there going to be a liberal caucus now that won't say anything unless, or won't vote for anything unless it's absolutely everything that they want?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, there is that as you become more extreme, you become, there's that demand for ideological purity. And along with that is just very rigid attitudes. You know, the thing about, I saw an interview by George Stephanopoulos of Mitch Landrieu, who is the mayor of New Orleans. That happened just this Sunday, and he spoke about the need for Americans to address our real problems. and that, along with the need to stand up to hate, he talked about how Americans of all sorts of backgrounds interact and work with each other every day, and that there needs to be a focus on searching for common ground among our differences, as well as being disciplined, quote-unquote, in exercising civility. It was really refreshing for me to hear that, and I think that we definitely need our leaders to set those kinds of tones for our political discourse. What is your just reaction to that statement?
Well, I think that it's refreshing to hear a politician kind of be honest and say that the ends don't always justify the means. Mm-hmm. Back during the Iran-Contra scandal, George Mitchell was lecturing Oliver North. Oliver North said, well, the ends justify the means. And George Mitchell said, this country isn't about the ends. This country is about the means. Mm-hmm. And that's the processes that we go, allowing people to have their time to speak, respecting that someone can have a different view than you have. And if you don't sit down and listen rather than talk all the time, you'll never figure out where the common ground is. We live in a democracy which requires compromise, it requires pragmatism, and both of those are empty right now. They're gone. They're missing from our discourse. And to solve the real problems, such as access to healthcare, which is 1/6 of our economy, access to better education, because one of the things that why that letter so works to a certain group of people is they're not as educated to understand that that's hokum.
Right.
And I think that looking at how we repair our institutions and find the agreement, and there's more agreement out there among folks than you really want to admit. And it's just that there are too many politicians who are concerned with getting reelected rather than doing their job. Somehow we have to not reward them for not doing their job.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think the thing of it is that, and you know, what Mitch Landrieu was really talking about was just so key was seeking that common ground and not yelling and screaming at each other not engaging in this demonizing process. He was basically saying, look, we're all human beings here, and we need to work together and solve our problems. And unfortunately, John, you know, we have, again, run out of time. And I thank you very much for coming on Radioactive Magazine and discussing this all-important subject again.
My pleasure. It's been fun. Thank you.